Welcome to the KSTE Farm Hour. Here's KSTE's Farmer Fred, Fred Hoffman.
Yolo County agriculture is in the spotlight this week. In Woodland, sheriff's detectives recovered 70 stolen bee boxes, and those bees are critical to Yolo County's largest crop, almonds. Yes, the latest Yolo County Ag Report is out, and almonds remain number one. But there's a new crop in the second position. We have the details. We have an update on last week's story about the mystery seeds that have been mailed unsolicited to unsuspecting homeowners. And those masks you're wearing aren't just to ward off the coronavirus. As the summer California wildfire season continues, a shortage of N95 respirator masks threatens California's farm laborers who have to work in smoke-filled fields. And there's a huge fire in northeastern California that may be affecting the quality of the crops grown there. All that, a look at the weather ahead, crop progress reports, and a lot more on this week's KSTE Farm Hour. Let's get started. Yolo County Sheriff's detectives have reported the arrest of a man on suspicion of stealing more than 70 bee boxes. The Woodland Daily Democrat reports the arrest of Justin Perdue took place southwest of Woodland. Detectives served the search warrant as part of an ongoing ag theft investigation. They recovered more than 70 bee boxes full of honeybees, and they were worth over $18,000 along with beekeeping supplies. Bees in the boxes are used to pollinate almond orchards and other crops, which brings in millions of dollars to Yolo County. In fact, almonds are Yolo County's leading agricultural commodity. The boxes are typically marked in some way by the owners, and they're being returned. In Yolo County, bee box thefts aren't that common, according to the detectives. Honeybee theft has not been previously reported here in Yolo County as being very significant, although ask other beekeepers around the state, and it is a problem. Thefts in surrounding county of bee boxes, notably Butte and Yuba County, for example. The most recent bee theft report was in January from an Oregon-based beekeeper who told authorities he had 92 honeybee boxes brought to the state to pollinate almonds, and those disappeared from an orchard near Yuba City. And it's a problem in all almond-growing areas of the state. Merced County Sheriff's Department reported last January that thieves in western Merced County allegedly stole 32 honeybee colonies. Farm bankruptcies continue to rise, but the rate of new filings is slowing. The American Farm Bureau Federation's Chad Smith tells us bankruptcy filings rose 8% between June of 2019 and June of 2020.
The number of filings from June 2019 to June 2020 totaled 580. John Newton is the chief economist with the American Farm Bureau. He says the year-to-year numbers don't tell the entire story.
Well, it's a little bit of a mixed bag, and what we see is during the second quarter of 2020, Chapter 12 family farm bankruptcies actually slowed to about 115 filings. That's 50 filings below what we saw in the second quarter of 2019. But on an annual basis, Chapter 12 farm bankruptcies remain 8% higher than prior year levels.
Newton says farms in the Midwest, Northwest, and the Southeast were hit the hardest by bankruptcy.
When you look at the state that was hit the hardest from Chapter 12 bankruptcies, we continue to have our eyes on Wisconsin. It's led the country in terms of the number of bankruptcies for three consecutive years. And a lot of that has to do with low milk prices. I think when you look at other commodities in the Midwest, we've seen depressed corn and soybean prices. And out west, I think the trade war, a lot of those commodities were headed west towards China, so retaliatory tariffs may have impacted the farm income there.
Without further assistance for the struggling ag sector, Newton says another rise in Chapter 12 bankruptcy filings is possible.
One of the things we saw with COVID was many things had to go virtual. So I think that likely played a role in the slowing number of bankruptcy filings we saw this past quarter. I think the CARES Act stimulus certainly helped, but that stimulus is set to expire. And I think we could see Chapter 12 bankruptcies accelerate if we don't see the House and Senate come up with another stimulus package, not only for the broader U.S. economy, but for agriculture.
Chad Smith, Washington.
After dethroning the tomato as Yolo County's most valuable crop in 2018, almonds held on to the top spot last year in Yolo County, and they even increased in value. The Davis Enterprise reports that tomatoes slipped to number 3 in the 2019 county crop report, behind a new one in the second spot, wine grapes, which were valued at just over $108 million compared to tomatoes' $107.5 million. Almonds, though, continue to be number 1 by a big margin. The gross value of almonds increased from $113 million in 2018 to $157 million in 2019. And it's not because more acres were planted, it's just that the value of the crop went up. Meanwhile, wine grapes made a big jump into the second spot, with the gross value increasing from $83 million in 2018 to more than $108 million in 2019. The increase was most notable in red wine grapes, which increased in value by $22 million. And even though Yolo County is famous for its processing tomatoes, even though they had about 1,900 more acres harvested in 2019, tomato growers ended up with less production and less yield per acre. Still, tomatoes ranked as Yolo County's third most valuable crop in 2019, followed by rice and then organic production. Rounding out the top 10 were walnuts, alfalfa hay, sunflower seeds, pistachios, and then nursery crops. Falling out of the top 10 were cattle and calves, which dropped in value from $16.7 million in 2018 to $16 million in 2019. Overall, the gross value of Yolo County's ag production increased by 13% between 2018 and 2019, jumping from $675 million to more than $765 million. And who are Yolo County's top export partners? It would be Japan, followed by China and Mexico.
Low commodity prices, unusual market conditions are making it harder for some farmers to pay for vital crop insurance policies, and so
we want to make sure we take care of those producers and give them time to get some crops harvested this fall and be able to pay those premiums.
Martin Barbary runs the USDA's Risk Management Agency. It's authorizing crop insurance providers to do some things that will help producers in that regard, and here's one of the new ones.
Premiums that would be due, like the August 15th billing date, which is the big one. I mean, that's a lot of the corn, soybean, grain, sorghum, a lot of crops across the country. Billing date's August 15th, which makes them due October 1st. So what will happen is they won't be required to make that payment until December 1st and won't have to pay any interest on that premium for that period of time, which normally they would.
For more information on some other new crop insurance flexibilities, go online to rma.usda.gov, rma.usda.gov. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Here's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey with a look at the national weather picture for the week ahead.
Looking ahead to week two, and this covers the mid-August time period from the 11th through the 17th. Looks like a bit of a transition in the current weather pattern as we head deeper into August. We are expecting the return of above normal temperatures pretty much everywhere along and east of a line from the Four Corners region to the Northern Plains, which means above normal temperatures expected in places like the Midwest and the Northeast. Cooler than normal conditions will gradually deepen across the far west, encompassing the Pacific Coast states, the Great Basin, and the Northern Rockies. In terms of rainfall patterns from August 11th through the 17th, much of the eastern half of the country expecting near or above normal precipitation. Exceptions will include New England and South Florida, and then much of the western half of the country from the Pacific Coast to the Plains expecting drier than normal conditions, which means another period of very feeble monsoon-related showers in the southwest. One exception will be some wetter than normal conditions affecting the Pacific Northwest.
A little closer to home for the period August 11th through the 17th for the southern Sacramento and northern San Joaquin Valley. Temperatures, it looks like, will be near normal with highs in the upper 80s to low 90s, overnight lows near 60, and sunny skies. And if you are wondering, AccuWeather says the next chance of rain here, the first week of November. Here's this week's California Crop Report. In Tulare County, harvested fields were being disked and planted for silage and other forage crops. Silage corn continues to grow at a steady rate with an increase in irrigation. Alfalfa is maturing and continuing to be harvested. Bean fields are flowering. Cotton plants were blooming and underwent weed control. In the Sacramento Valley, rice is progressing well as warmer nights were contributing to crop maturity. Stone fruit orchards were irrigated. Grapes continue to develop. Table grape varieties are being harvested in Tulare County. Peach, plum, nectarine, apricot, lemon, and grapefruit harvest is ongoing. Persimmon and kiwi fruit development is progressing well. Late navel and Valencia orange harvest continues. Pomegranate and olive bloom is ongoing. Olive orchard pruning occurred where necessary. Strawberry and blueberry growth steadily progressed. Among the nut crops, orchard floor preparation is continuing. Almonds, walnuts, and pistachios continue to develop. Down in Tulare County, eggplants, peppers, sweet corn, yellow squash, zucchini, and tomatoes continue to mature, and they're being harvested. Tomato, cucumber, and zucchini harvests continue here in the Sacramento Valley. In Colusa, Sacramento, Solano, and Yolo counties, Brussels sprouts and squash were progressing well. Sweet corn was harvested in San Joaquin County. Brassica, romaine, and broccoli were being harvested in Monterey County. Irrigated pastures are reported to be in good to excellent condition. Foothill rangeland and non-irrigated pasture were in fair to poor condition. Cattle and sheep grazed on retired cropland as well as on dry grain fields. Cattle supplemental feeding continues to compensate for poor quality range. Bees were active in squash, alfalfa for seed, and melon fields. Don't forget, the KSTE Farm Hour is available on your schedule. You can listen to it live, of course, at 6:50 on the AM dial here in Northern California, or stream it live via the iHeartRadio app. And, of course, the KSTE Farm Hour is available as a podcast. Download it from your favorite third-party podcast aggregator, and that includes the iHeartRadio app, Apple Music, and Google Play. Here's an update on last week's story about the mystery seed packets that people have been receiving across the country, including here in California. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has identified 14 kinds of seeds in those mysterious packages that appear to have been sent unsolicited to people around the country. All 50 states have issued warnings about the packages, some of which contain flowering plants like morning glory seeds, hibiscus, and roses. That, according to Osama El-Lissi, he's with the Plant Protection Program of the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. He said the other packages contain vegetables such as cabbage, as well as herbs, including mint, sage, rosemary, and lavender. A spokesperson for the USDA said the department is urging anyone who receives the packages not to plant them and to contact, here in California, your county agricultural commissioner. Be sure to keep the seeds and packaging, including the mailing label, until you receive further instruction. And the USDA insists that at this time they don't have any evidence indicating this is something other than a brushing scam. That's where people receive unsolicited items from a seller who then posts false customer reviews in order to boost their sales. The USDA is currently collecting seed packages from recipients and are still testing their contents to determine if they do contain anything that could be of concern to U.S. agriculture or the environment.
Even before financial challenges of the last 2 years, contraction in the number of dairy operations in the U.S. have been underway for some time.
The number of dairy farms has been declining pretty steadily for a long time, at a pace of about 4% a year. It's declined every year.
USDA research economist James McDonald says the 2017 Census of Agriculture recorded over 30,000 operations with fewer than 200 dairy cows, down from almost 48,000 a decade prior.
Broadly, what's going on is that production is shifting to much larger farms. So that total milk production in the United States has been growing steadily over time. The total number of cows on farms has declined but really stabilized, I would say, in the last 15 years. And the number of farms continues to decline because cows and production are shifting to fewer but much larger farms.
This is one of the trends associated with consolidation in the dairy industry. Not a surprise, according to McDonald. Yet what might be, for observers outside the dairy sector, is this.
What we mean by larger is what's really changed over time. Most cows today are on farms with herds of 1,000 or more cows, but where the real expansion is going on is in very large herds, places with 5 to 10,000, or even up to 30,000 cows in a large site on a dairy farm.
Quite a shift compared to just a decade to two decades ago, and one connected to economies of scale.
On average, far more larger farms are able to realize scale economies and lower costs, and so the finances of the business have strongly favored them over the years.
McDonald says, meanwhile, recent Farm Bill safety net programs for dairy have helped slow down the decline in small dairy farms. Yet,
as a fraction of the total revenues that farmers receive if you're a small-scale dairy farmer, they're still pretty modest.
However, as more small producers turn to robotic milking systems and other innovations, McDonald suggests,
if robots turn out to work and get widely adopted, they could provide an advantage for smaller farms or slow that rapid shift of production to larger farms that we've been seeing.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
With the state's wildfire season beginning to intensify, farm groups say they're looking for solutions to a lack of N95 respirators. The California Farm Bureau Federation reports that state regulations require the respirators to be available to outdoor employees whenever wildfires worsen air quality, but the masks themselves have been in short supply since the pandemic started. Groups representing the fresh produce business have asked Congress to include resources for farm employee safety in the next COVID-19 relief package. And on a related note, the Farm Bureau reports that farmers in northeastern California say they expect smoke damage to crops from the Caldwell Fire, which has burned nearly 81,000 acres of land up in Modoc and Siskiyou counties. Officials continue to assess damage to grazing land scorched by the fire, and farmers say smoke will likely hurt the quality of hay, potatoes, onions, and other crops. One farmer says irrigated farmland acted as a buffer that stopped the fire from spreading to some areas.
USDA is moving forward with a third round of the Farmers to Families Food Box program, which is aimed at helping families meet food needs as they weather the pandemic.
We're on our third tranche beginning here at the 1st of August there. We've done two. One was in May and June. The other was June and July. And now we'll do one through really probably October.
The announcement came as Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue was visiting North Carolina's Flavor First, a growing and packing company.
Kirby is at the beginning with all the producers, his relationship with his colleague producers from all over. You saw us touring out there today from apples to peaches to squash to tomatoes to grapes even from California.
The Kirby he referred to is one of Flavor First's owners, farmer Kirby Johnson.
I was telling Sonny on the farm this morning, I was actually planting green beans when it happened, and I got a good friend of mine, Bill Scarborough, gave me a call about this program. And after I talked to him about 15 minutes, I was going down the road real slow, of course, planting beans, and I laughed to myself. I said, by the time this program gets in motion, it'll be over.
However, he says he was surprised when it happened faster than he thought it would.
Let me tell you, that was a Tuesday. The following Thursday, I was packing in this packing house vegetables to go to the people. And I can't recommend all of y'all for putting it together that quick because, you know, I've done a lot of government stuff. Nothing has ever been done this quick, I don't think, in the history of especially produce and getting the people that need it, needed it. They don't need it too much now. They need it now.
Usually these kind of procurement and contracting results take 12 to 18 months in the federal government. I'm from a farm, too, and you can't wait on when stuff gets ready to go, it's got to go.
So, Secretary Perdue says USDA stepped up to the plate.
I'm really proud of our team at USDA for putting this together in such a quick time period. Really, from the time we conceived it till packing boxes was three weeks, that's just unheard of.
Meanwhile, he also took the opportunity to thank the local organization in Asheville, North Carolina, that helped distribute the boxes to the people there who need them.
I want to compliment the Baptist Home Missions, who was really the contractor here, who provides that last mile of distribution over 200 sites around it. Without them, it wouldn't work. So you got the growers, you got the distributors, and you got the last mile distributors.
The Farmers to Families Food Box program provides boxes of fresh produce, dairy, or meat products, or a combination, to families to take home.
You can see in there quality products. This is first-line product. This isn't throwaway food. This is first-quality food that you and I would be proud to have in our homes.
As of July 29th, the Farmers to Families Food Box program delivered 50 million food boxes. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
By mapping the genome of a key grapevine pest, University of California scientists say they've learned how the insect spreads, which could help them learn how to stop it. The research involves phylloxera, which feeds off and damages grapevines. Working with colleagues in France, UC Riverside specialists have identified genes that allows the insects to colonize vines. The California Farm Bureau reports that could lead to breeding of grape rootstock that can resist the pest. The California Farm Bureau reports that seeking out California-grown grapes at the grocery store benefits rural communities around the state, that according to the California Table Grape Commission. It's developed a marketing campaign encouraging shoppers to support the state's farmers as well as their employees. The campaign will feature radio ads in Spanish and English. California farms produce practically all the table grapes grown in the United States, but they do face competition from imported grapes.
It's called Optimia, short for Optimizing Indoor Agriculture, a research initiative supported by the U.S. Department of Agriculture being carried out in several universities. The goal, help make this emerging industry of controlled environment or other indoor growing systems more efficient, more able to make a profit. Scientists are currently studying all kinds of combinations of types of lights, temperature, humidity, and other factors, and how they affect production of things like lettuce and other leafy greens. But what about how these variables affect the eating quality, the taste of crops? Michigan State University's Roberto Lopez says they haven't been able to do any consumer taste panels yet.
One of the challenges that we currently have with the consumer panels, actually we just received an email from the university yesterday, is that any type of research that we do with obviously human subjects is going to have to wait until after the pandemic.
But they do intend to do taste panels because the eating quality of crops will be an important factor in making indoor agriculture a feasible, profitable endeavor. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The coronavirus pandemic. There are more changes in store for agriculture and Americans shopping for food. Shopping and eating behaviors will likely be altered for the next 12 to 18 months as a result of the pandemic we're in. And a new analysis is dairy supply chains are going to need to adjust. The California Farm Bureau reports that the cooperative lender CoBank says people have bought more fluid milk and processed cheese during the pandemic. With stay-at-home orders affecting restaurant demand, the report says some dairy processors will need to retool to make products for at-home consumption. New research quantifies how forest management activities such as mechanical thinning and prescribed burns contribute to increased downstream water availability. The California Farm Bureau reports that a study of 20 years of data and satellite imagery of the Yuba and American rivers, scientists at UC Merced have determined the forest management actions could enhance runoff in those basins by up to 10%. That's enough water for as many as 4 million people.
Animal disease prevention and preparedness. Essential in keeping the nation's livestock and poultry animals and supplies protected from outbreaks.
USDA has a system of overlapping safeguards in place to keep many livestock diseases out of the country.
A system that has worked effectively for several decades now. According to the Agriculture Department's Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, Greg Ibaugh. Yet with new and growing animal disease threats around the world, stakeholders in the country's livestock and poultry sectors are increasing their preparedness and protection efforts. I'm Rod Bain, and coming up, the latest in animal disease preparedness efforts in this edition of Agriculture USA. It's a part of the 2018 Farm Bill, the latest tools for stakeholders to approach animal disease preparedness and disease threats to our nation's poultry and livestock.
A three-legged stool approach. One of them was a vaccine bank. The other leg on that stool was having an effective laboratory network in place. And the third leg was to do preparatory stuff, emergency planning and exercises that would help the industry be prepared and know what was going to happen in the event of an animal disease outbreak.
As Agriculture Department Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs Greg Ibaugh points out, preparedness against animal disease threats has long been in place in the U.S. A series of overlapping protection and prevention systems have kept several animal diseases out of our nation for years. In the case of foot and mouth disease, over nine decades. However,
with African swine fever raging around the world and our effectiveness of keeping that out of the U.S., it creates more concern about those foreign animal diseases as we see more and more trade and more travel between countries.
With an animal disease like FMD or ASF having significant impacts on livestock and poultry populations and trade with other nations. Some of those preparedness tools include what the undersecretary calls an insurance in the remote event a foot and mouth disease outbreak occurs in our country. The purchase of vaccine to be housed in the National Animal Animal Vaccine and Veterinary Countermeasures Bank.
USDA has invested with this first purchase for the new vaccine bank $27 million that will help us purchase vaccine to have in reserve in the event there should be a FMD outbreak.
Undersecretary Ibaugh adds that the recent purchase of vaccine also increases our nation's rapid response capabilities in the event of a foot and mouth disease outbreak. He also notes that stakeholders, ranging from USDA to the livestock industry, need to work together to be judicious about how an FMD vaccine is used and when.
Foot and mouth disease occurring in the United States has trade ramifications. Using vaccine also would have additional trade ramifications. And so we would want to make sure we're working with the industry to decide when and how to use the vaccine. But it could be a very useful tool to try to put a wall around an affected area.
Another key approach in animal disease preparedness involves traceability, also as a means to increase response time in the event of a disease or potential outbreak. The undersecretary notes over the last two decades,
the pork and poultry industry were able to adopt and identify schemes for animal traceability and have complete traceability in place already.
Setting up a traceability system in the cattle industry, however, has proved more challenging due to more producers and less integration. So recently, USDA announced a proposal now available for public comment in the Federal Register, a transition of certain and approved radio frequency ID tags as official identification for transport across interstate lines.
We have worked with the beef industry to figure out how we can start phasing out some of the manual systems that require auction barns and veterinarians to read tags, write down long numbers in those that are visible on those tags, and then be able to share them on health certificates or official documents as animals move across the United States.
The new proposal would also apply to bison as well, as bison and bovines share several animal diseases. And in terms of the transition period to RFID official identification, a period lasting until January 1st, 2023, Undersecretary Ibaugh says that should give livestock producers ample time to prepare and ear tag their animals, including metal ID tags, through the transition timeline. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Have you seen the price of cheese lately? Well, it's going up. Sales are continuing through retail, export, and food aid programs. Cheese prices have surged to records. Even analysts are describing the price movement as eye-popping, given that milk prices had plunged at the start of pandemic-related restrictions. The Ag Alert newspaper of the California Farm Bureau Federation reports that dairy farmers have yet to see the effects of that cheese market surge, though it may show up in their June income.
Before we start our story for today, a little bee music. Is that in B-flat by any means? I can't tell, but of course, on a serious note about bees...
Bees are disappearing at an alarming rate.
Bees have become the kind of poster child for the rest of the insects.
They are vital to the economy and vital to...
A few of the voices coming from the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization the other day, May 20th, declaring it World Bee Day, and its theme, Bee Engaged. So, coming up, lots of ways to be engaged with bees and other pollinators on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford. Well, a little more bee music here.
And if you want honey, honey, you gotta take care of the hive.
Take care of the hives and all the places that not just honeybees hang out, but all bees and pollinators live. And the Food and Agriculture Organization has just launched an effort that will combine people everywhere in the world with bees and with cameras and with smartphones, and it will get lots of people engaged with bees in a fun way with a new app called World Bee Count. Here's how it works. People go out and take pictures of bees and other pollinators, send them in using the app. And project coordinator Max Runzel says these pictures show up on a world map.
And you'll be able to zoom in on any sighting. Each position where a picture has been taken is a yellow hexagon on the map. And wherever you are, you can look and scroll through the pictures of the bees and pollinators that have been taken. And it's an easy process to start submitting. And once a day, we update the map, so it can take about a day till you see your pictures going live.
That sounds like fun, but Max Runzel says it's a lot more than that. Over the years, he says they'll get hundreds of thousands of pictures and locations, and that will help
build a powerful monitoring tool that tells us about the health of bees and pollinators across the world.
And Joseph Cossier at Appalachian State University is going to be working with the data from the project, and he says it will indeed help researchers
to really understand what is happening to our pollinators around the world and what can we do to help them.
To get the app and get started, go to this web address, beescount.org, beescount.org.
So this is something everybody everywhere can do.
But there are many other things we can do to help bees and other pollinators. Experts tell us that if we have a yard or a garden, we can attract bees there, then help them out at the same time. Dr. Dave Goulson, biology professor at the University of Sussex, says first,
plant some bee-friendly flowers. There's lots of advice out there about which ones are great.
Your local extension service can help you with that. And another expert, Jeff Pettis, with the International Federation of Beekeepers Association, says plant flowering plants that are native to your area.
And especially something that blooms during the summer.
In the spring, lots of blossoms available for bees.
But during the summer months and early fall, we need flowering plants.
Next, six more words of advice from Dave Goulson.
Don't mow your lawn so often.
I could go over that. And Dr. Samuel Ramsey with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Bee Lab in Maryland explains the rationale for that.
Several of the flowers that bees depend on early in the season are plants that we consider to be weeds. And we're very quick to mow them down and decry their existence. But things like dandelions are wonderful.
Wonderful for the bees and butterflies and other pollinators. And Dave Goulson says, remember, we're not just talking about honeybees here. There are many types of bees that help pollinate our food crops. There are so-called solitary bees.
A solitary bee is just a female bee makes a little nest on her own and fills it with pollen, lays some eggs. No workers, no queens or anything like that. And some of these solitary bees like to nest in horizontal holes. Naturally, they might nest in a clay bank or in a hole made in a dead tree by a burrowing beetle, say. And those kind of habitats are in short supply these days in the modern tidy world.
But we can build a so-called bee hotel for them.
Just get a block of wood and drill a bunch of holes in it, roughly 8 millimeter diameter. Or get some bamboo canes and chop them up and bundle them together, stick them on a south-facing wall or fence. And you've got a bee hotel, and with a bit of luck, you'll get mason bees and leafcutter bees and yellow-faced bees and a whole bunch of others move in, and it's really fascinating to watch.
So Dave says if you put in the right plants and are not quite so strict about weeds in the yard and mowing the yard, if you try not to use pesticides, and if you buy or build bee shelters or hotels, be patient and you could end up with
your own little bee paradise outside your back door.
And helping our bees can make you feel nice and swarm inside. So get busy on this. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The pandemic has spurred people's interest in fresh food, according to the California Farm Bureau. And speakers at a virtual conference of fresh produce professionals said they expect that could continue after the virus fades. A firm that researches trends in the food business says more people now value freshness and health in their foods. As restaurants continue to struggle, produce suppliers say they're trying to package fresh fruits and vegetables in ways that require less labor in restaurant kitchens.
Let's pull out this timeless 1983 hit song from Guy Clark.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What will life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love.
True. And if the sales figures from this nation's garden stores and online garden retailers are correct, this spring, many of us are going to be starting a garden for the first time ever and trying our hands at homegrown tomatoes.
Tomatoes, they're not that difficult to grow once you just give them some basic requirements or basic needs.
That's what they all say. That's Kansas State University Extension gardening expert Dennis Patton. So basic needs, huh? Well, we'll get to those in a moment. First, Dennis, what's the biggest mistake that people make when trying to grow tomatoes?
The biggest mistake people make is planting them too early when the soils are still too cold and there's a chance of a frost. And then the plant just sits there and it kind of gets stunted. And then it's kind of hard to wake up and get going. So I think that's one of the biggest mistakes. So here in the Kansas City area, we don't recommend planting tomatoes till May 1st or even Mother's Day. And that's when our soils have warmed up enough, so they're going to get off and growing. We're going to have those nice sunny days to provide good growth.
So your time to plant will depend on where in the country you are. Best way to find that out is to check with your state's extension service. They've got experts like Dennis to help you out. Dennis, he mentioned providing our tomatoes with their basic needs. One of those needs is at least 6 hours a day of direct sun.
And I think the other limiting factor I hear with a lot of people in tomatoes is that need for sun, that 6+ hours of sun a day. And a lot of neighborhoods that have mature trees or people that live in ever-increasing, you know, condominium, townhomes, apartments sometimes struggle to find that sunlight.
So your tomatoes may not do so well without that 6 to 8 hours a day of sunlight.
So definitely check the sun. Second is they're going to need good drainage. So we try to avoid spots that tend to hold water, stay wet for a longer period after rain. And then we also like to have, you know, that those vegetable gardens somewhat near to a water source, because in most parts of our country, we're going to have to do some supplemental watering during the summer months.
And that brings up the third mistake many of us make with our
homegrown potatoes.
And that is overwatering in combination with having the plants in soils or pots that don't drain well. Most experts say only water when the soil feels dry below the 1-inch level. But watering advice varies depending on where you live, what variety you're trying to grow, what kind of soil you're using. But for best results, Dennis Patton again says check with your local Ag Extension Service. They've got the information to help you with those homegrown tomatoes. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
With sensors and cloud connections, farmers today can monitor field and well conditions remotely and schedule irrigations accordingly. Recently, the California Farm Bureau Federation went down to Monterey County and talked with one vineyard owner who uses a homegrown system to collect and analyze data. Here's Greg Gonzalez, Monterey County Vineyard Manager, explaining the system.
So it's an in-field communication node. Is a radio, a battery, a solar power node, and then a communications antenna. And so this specific node is for valve actuation. So it's turning on and off irrigation valves. So you see down here, we have our two irrigation valves. So this one node is monitoring or actuating two valves.
Alex Bugrov is a Monterey County well monitor developer. He talks about how a computerized well monitor helps with groundwater management.
This is the well bubbler. It is an automated well level sensor with a cloud connection. So the black poly airline here runs to the wellhead, and from here we set a small diameter airline into the well. The well level here was recovering, and the standing water level was about 261 feet up until about 6 a.m. this morning when the farm irrigated, and then they basically pumped with the well level down to about 315 feet. So that's getting pretty close to the pump.
And Monterey County Berry Farm Food Safety Manager Alejandra Roca explains how a berry grower uses an app to stay on top of food safety.
So before using Heavy Connect, we used to collect these thick binders with a lot of paper, and it had every day's checklist. And so we first had to get these checklists from the foreman passed on to the supervisor, and then it made it to the office. Now they're done on this app. And on this app, we have a checklist for every crew. I can go ahead and pull it up either here or on my dashboard. So once I pull it up, I can review the checklist, make sure everything was done correct. I can check the time. I can check the GPS where it was actually done, so I have more control as the food safety coordinator.
That organizing app, again, is called Heavy Connect. And according to the Ag Alert newspaper, Heavy Connect is also valuable for others. Pest control advisors and fertilizer applicators can also log in and post reports of the work they've done.
It sounds very ominous if you're an insect. Several of these critters have had, well, not so fortunate encounters with what some have dubbed
bug vacuum. It's really just known as a suction trap, and these suction traps are not new. They've been used in different places. I think perhaps Europe was the first to start using these some 50 plus years ago.
And USDA researcher Glenn Hartman notes that contrary to what one may expect the intent of these bug vacuums to be,
kills bugs dead.
Their purpose in Illinois and an entire network of such structures across several central U.S. states is to gather important data on pest threats to crops. Research colleague Doris Lagos Kutz says in the Illini state, these 20-foot structures were first used to collect information on soybean aphids.
There was this huge problem with soybean aphids, and there was not much known about the phenology, about the tracking when these aphids start to fly, increase population, start migrating in the summer, what's going on in the fall.
Important information needed to understand flight patterns and geographic distribution of soybean aphids in order to combat these invasive pests. Pests that for the last two decades have threatened the nation's over $40 billion soy crop. Yet over time,
it kind of grew into, well, but we're also capturing all these other insects, including mosquitoes and thrips and just everything.
The network of bug vacuums in operation also bring in a wide range of data on insect varieties pertinent to a particular region, from sugarcane aphids in Louisiana to forest-oriented invasive pests in Wisconsin. A collection and study of insects from bug vacuums can shed light on other important data, such as species that may become insecticide-resistant to certain applications, changing habitat patterns, or expansion of new areas for an insect, and in turn, new methods to control these pests. Hartman adds that with other organisms collected via the bug vacuum, microbes, fungi, and DNA, for example, and the potential one day to expand this network across the country.
It's just like the tip of the iceberg finding that we've done so far, and there's a lot more that could be done with these traps over the decades, really.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for listening to the KSTE Farm Hour, heard every Sunday from noon until 1 p.m. Pacific Time, and available anytime as a podcast at KSTE.com.